Turn our Bibles to Judges chapter 7. Judges chapter 7. We're continuing on now and coming to what seems to be, what looks like, the big moment here in Gideon's life. The moment that God was preparing him for, dealing with these Midianites that were coming and oppressing the people of Israel. They had been coming for 7 years and had just when they came into town or into the country, they would steal from the Israelites their food, their animals, just strip the crops bare, leave them desolate, and then take off. And this was happening cyclically, and the Midianites were gathered in the valley of Jezreel. And where they were at, we'll see here as we read the text, they were described as being like locusts without number, just thousands upon thousands of Midianites and Amalekites and other sons of the east. And God had called Gideon. The Lord appeared to him himself and called this man while he was threshing wheat down in a wine press. And we talked about that and what that signifies and how Gideon just completely doubted that he could be the warrior that God called him to be. He doubted God, but yet ultimately he realized who the Lord was, and there he made peace with God, and God gave him a mission. We talked about that first mission last time, how he was called to pull down the altar of Baal and the Asherah that was at his father's house, and how he did that at night for a fear of his family and the other people in the town, but yet he did it. And then after that, God intervened through Gideon's father, and his life was spared when everyone else rose up to kill him. And as God told Gideon to gather the Israelites, actually the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon, and he came and sent and blew a trumpet and called the Abiezerites, his immediate family there, and the rest of the tribe of Manasseh came, and then Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali. Altogether, 32,000 men answered the call of Gideon as he was under the influence and power of the Spirit of God to gather this force of Israel to face the Midianites. But even after all these men came, Gideon suffered his doubts. We talked about it. It doesn't seem that he doubted what God was calling him to do. It sounds like he was very aware of what God was calling him to do. But what he seemed to doubt was God's ability to bring it to pass. And so there was the test of the fleece twice, where Gideon tested God, and God was very gracious and patient and answered on both of those occasions. And that was the close of chapter 6. So now we're coming to Judges chapter 7. Any questions or comments on the background here? So let's start reading. We're going to read the first 8 verses. And how about we have someone read the first 4 and then someone read verses 5 through 8. Who would like to read? Josiah, you start for us. And Jonathan, would you like to read tonight some? How about you read verses 5 through 8, okay? Okay, go ahead, Josiah.
Then the men of Ephraim said to him...
Whoop, you're in Judges chapter 8. We're back in chapter 7.
Then Jerubbaal, son of Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the sea of Terah. And the camp of Midian was north of them, by the hill of Morah in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now therefore proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead.' Then 22,000 people returned, and 10,000 remained. And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And anyone of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, shall go with you. And anyone who, of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, shall not go.
So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps it, you shall set by himself. Likewise, every one who kneels down to dig, and the number of those who laps, putting their hands to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people kneeled down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands, and let the all the others go, every man to his home. So the people took provisions in their hands and the trumpets, and he sent off hands west of Israel. Every man put his tent, but retained the 300 men and the camp of Midianite was below him in the valley.
Excellent job, Jonathan. Thank you for reading that. And so Gideon has this force of 32,000 men, and they're south of the Midianites. And he takes them to, they got up early and camped beside the spring of Harod. Interestingly, the name of that spring, Harod, comes from the Hebrew word which means to tremble. The spring of trembling. As we see, it's a fitting name for this location based upon what's about to happen. And so they get here to this spring, and God talks to Gideon. And he says, we need to reduce this number of people. We have too many here. There's 32,000. This is too many. Why did the number of Gideon's army need to be reduced? This is a really important question, and I know the answer is really obvious, but we need to keep the answer to this question in the back of our mind to help us understand the rest of what's about to happen in this passage. Why did the number of the troops need to be reduced? To show that it was God that was the one who was winning this battle and not the power of the Israelites. And so, what was the first cut? What was the basis of the first cut that was made in these troops to start thinning down the herd? What was Gideon told to do to get rid of some of these men?
Whoever was afraid.
Whoever was afraid, go home. And when Gideon said, whoever among you is afraid and trembling, let him go and leave Mount Gilead. Go back home. 22,000 people left. And so he only had 10,000. 10,000 who were not afraid. Now let me ask you a question, and I want you to think about your answer. Why were these 10,000 men not afraid. Why were these 10,000 men remaining with Gideon? Were these 10,000 men of Israel who had great faith in God, strong, faithful men of Israel? Huh? Maybe they had fought before? We don't really have an answer to that question, but as we read this text, I think what's really important to remember is that this whole thing happened because Israel was not following after God. And remember when Gideon pulled down the altar of Baal and the Asherah in his own hometown at his own father's house? If his own father hadn't intervened, he would have died. They would have killed him because these people were idolaters. They had all gone after false gods. And so when we have 10,000 of these men who were left, we're not told why they weren't afraid. Maybe some of them had some degree of confidence in the Lord. Maybe they had some degree of confidence in Gideon. Maybe they thought they were tough. I mean, we've all met people who won't walk away from a fight. And they're cocky. And they're sure, and you look at them and you think, man, you don't have a chance in the world. But you listen to their mouth, you think they could, you know, beat up Mike Tyson. You know, he was a younger guys, he was a heavyweight boxing champion back in the day. Okay? They think they could do anything. Right? I mean, you hear some people talk and they have no fear of anything. I mean, we don't know. Maybe some of these people were like, the Midianites have taken everything else from me. I have nothing to lose. I don't care. We don't know for sure why they had the courage to stay. But I don't think it would be right for us to assume that these were all just 10,000 godly, faithful men. Because we don't see any evidence of that being the character of this people.
When we look at the qualifications the Lord gave Gideon, those who are afraid and trembling, that denotes to me that, yeah, they were afraid, but it was showing because they were trembling.
Mm-hmm.
These 10,000 that remain, as you described, maybe they were afraid, but they were showing it because they were cocky or they just, you know, too manly to admit it, you know, or let anybody think that they were afraid. They didn't want to be seen as cowards. The others didn't mind. So I'm thinking, being afraid wasn't the only qualification.
Yeah.
It was afraid
and trembling. Yeah. Maybe the 22,000 who left were the more honest of the 32,000 that were there. Anyone else have a thought before we go on? So that was the first cut. We're down to 10,000 men. Go ahead.
I was just thinking that God knew which ones were afraid and trembling or whatever, and He knew that that would be the biggest, quickest way to divide the group. I just think that's interesting to think about, too. Just that He knew, like, He was beginning His
whittling down of the group, and he knew
that,
you know, the biggest majority
were afraid,
and
so he made that his
first cut.
And
it was effective. Right. Very effective. And so now there's 10,000, and we go down to verse 4, and so Gideon, you know, kind of wonder what he's thinking. You know? These were 32,000 men who came under the influence of the Spirit of the Lord when Gideon was clothed with the Spirit of the Lord himself and blew the trumpet, and all these people came. I mean, God's power was on this to have all these people come. And yet there were still 22,000 who were afraid and trembling. It's kind of interesting to notice that. So now we We come down to this next 10,000. And the Lord said to Gideon, we need to cut this down some more. The people are still too many. So I'm going to weed them out for you. Bring them down to the water. This spring of trembling. The spring of Harod there. Bring them down to the spring. And here's the test. I want you to separate into two groups. First one are the people who, when they come to this water, basically it sounds like they use their hand and they grab up water and lap it up like a dog. Laps water. And the second group would be the other people who would, when they get to the spring, they would get down there on their knees and they would drink water from the stream down on their knees. Maybe they put their head down to the water or some other way. But those who kneel down versus those who lap the water up like a dog without kneeling. And Gideon separated these people into two groups. And so you had 9,700 that kneeled down and 300 that didn't kneel down but lapped up the water like a dog. And the Lord said to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped and will give the Midianites into your hand. So let all the other people, the 9,700, each man go to his home. Now, the first test was based on a question that was posed to the men. The second test was one of observation. This wasn't like trying to ask them a question, how do you feel? It was just take them down, tell them all to drink, and you watch them. You're just going to watch how they respond. What was the difference between the men who lapped the water like a dog and those who knelt down to drink water?
Those that in the place of a battlefield and you're ready for battle, you're going to always be ready for battle no matter what you're doing. If you're drinking water, if you're eating or whatever, so if you're going to lap up the water with your hand and you can still see what's going on around you, whether and if you're going to lay down and lap up the water with your mouth, you're not going to be able to see around you. It kind of shows a person who's always paying attention.
Okay. And that's the explanation that's most commonly given on this passage, is that the ones who did not kneel but who bowed down were the ones who were more aware of their surroundings, would be better, more capable warriors and fighters in the battlefield, rather than those who would let down their guard and get down on their knees to drink water. So was God calling out the bravest and the elite crack force, the best 300 fighters of Israel for this battle? Was that the point? That's not where this was headed. When these men went and executed this battle plan they were about to get, y'all know what's going to happen, right? There'll be some trumpets and some torches and some jars. You don't hear anything about swords. Not in this first part anyway. Did they have to go and do some stealthy maneuvers, go in there and some fancy sword fighting, you know, some Lord of the Rings type stuff, you know? Anything like that going on with this? So, it's a lot of times people look at the passage, there's this tendency to kind of want to say, these were the best of the best, the ones without fear, the ones who were the most alert, that God was calling out for this elite force. But everything we see about the passage is not about in any way trying to demonstrate the strength of Israel, but rather trying to demonstrate the absolute weakness of Israel but the strength of God. I mean, that was the whole point of this whole exercise. And so it's hard to say. I mean, honestly, when you look at this passage, to know what's the difference between the two, it may just be God was just using another means to whittle people down. One's really not better than the other. It's hard to say. It's hard to be definitive about all that. The point was, at the end, all you had were 300 men. And there's no indication that these were the best, the brightest, the strongest, the most skillful. They were just the 300 men that were chosen based upon the test that God had given Gideon. His army was, this is a quote I was reading in a commentary I thought was good. The object was to reduce Gideon's army to a force not of a particular kind, but of a particular number. The 300 are not meant to be an elite, but a group so inadequate that when the battle is won, God declares, it cannot be a case of Israel saying, my own hand has delivered me. Hebrews 11, I think, is an important passage for us just to kind of glance at, because this is our New Testament, kind of our touchstone to go back to remember how to understand what we're reading. Hebrews 11, verses 32 through 34. For what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. And then here, listen, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. And so the sense is of, in weakness, they were made strong. And the point I think that God is trying to demonstrate here in all of this is the absolute weakness of Israel. What do we take away as a lesson from this for us? What do we learn about our own tendencies in all this?
To a trial that's so big that you should rely on the Lord instead of on your own strength and get you through.
We have to rely on God when we come up to these enormous trials and not count our strength as the ability to make it through or the possibility of making it through something, but count the strength of God. You know, I have to reckon Him rather than reckoning ourselves. Absolutely. What else?
I can't take any credit.
We can't take any credit. We can have a tendency to steal God's glory. I mean, it can be a real tendency that we want to take it. Therefore, it's often necessary for the Lord to strip us of our own glory so that His glory may be seen in us. The Apostle Paul had to wrestle through that lesson really hard, you know, with his thorns in the flesh. And God just stripping him down. Why? Because of the greatness of the revelations God gave him. God gave him and let him see so much. But lest Paul would boast, the Lord had to just strip him down. And to where he was just begging God, just remove this, remove this, remove this. And the answer is, my strength is made perfect in weakness. My strength is most perfectly displayed by you being weak. And that's exactly what we see going on here. This thought really has been on my heart a lot. So just hear this for a moment. I mentioned this to Mary the other night as I was we're talking about these types of things. The issue with Israel here was not the Midianites. It was their relationship with God. This whole thing with the Midianites, what seemed to them to be the real issue, the real problem, was something that God providentially allowed to exist in their life to deal with this real issue, the issue of the relationship to Him. God could have taken those 32,000 men with Gideon and wiped out the Midianites. God could have never let the Midianites come in the first place. This is the point. God wants them to see, you need me. I am the God you should trust. You need to turn away from these things and look to me. That is the point of this book. And my friends, that is the same point God is continually trying to get across to each of us. Romans 8, 28 and 29. We know all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. For those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He would be the firstborn among many brethren. He wants you to be like Jesus. That is the point in your life. That's the point. He wants you to know Christ if you're lost. He wants you to be more like Christ if you're saved. And all these other things that happen in our life, the things that tend to draw our attention, the things that seem to be the real problems and the real issues, are just like the situation with Israel and the Midianites. All these other things that happen, all these other difficulties that come about in your life, they're not the real issue. But they are things that God will use to cause us to deal with the real issues of our heart towards Him. We're no different than this. We're no different than this. The reason this world has kept turning, lost friend, for you is to give you opportunity to be saved. And the reason that the Lord has left us down here, Christian, is to be a light for Christ and to continue to grow in this process of being more like Jesus. That is what it is about. And all this other stuff surrounding our life that God allows to come in, situations, it's all about that same thing in our lives. And when we start to realize that and surrender to God in those things, we can start to make the progress we need to make in the bigger issues, the important issues, the real issues of our relationship with Him. Any questions or thoughts?
I think about what you said about it's coming down to realize that everything around us is not about those other things. God can control a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's country going to pot, or whether it's the world, or threat of anything. It's just there to help us, remind us that we need God. We need to depend on God. It really is about God getting the honor and glory.
Mm-hmm.
For this people. And I was thinking as you were talking about the thing that I continue thinking about and have for years is, why do some people get saved and others don't? And sometimes that discussion is cast into the subject of good and bad, but it's not good and bad. I kind of concluded that it's just what you said. The people who get saved are those who realize they can't save themselves. And the people who don't get saved are those who think they can. God shows us all our weakness, and when we rebel against God, we're rebelling against that message that we need. And those who get saved are those who realize, yes, I do need God. And they then begin to look for Him, seek Him. And those who don't get saved are those who think they can do it on their own. And they don't need God. So even though it's not in the context of God and His people, but salvation can be put in, I think, in that same description, that it's about realizing we need God. And those who don't get saved never realize that. They still have their confidence in themselves. So, anyway, I'm still working on that. Trying to figure out why some people get saved and some don't.
It's a mystery. It's a deep mystery in all those things. But I think it's one of these things that this was left here for our instruction. This is left here to teach us and show us and let us see. Sometimes it's kind of like David when he was approached by Nathan, right? About the sheep, that whole illustration. And, you know, David, when he was looking outside of himself, was able to see clearly enough to realize what was right and wrong. And when he saw that outside himself, then Nathan was able to go, you see this? Well, that's you. And then all of a sudden, man, he's hit. And that's the same thing that the Lord's trying to do with this when, in drawing us to study these things, is to be able to look out and see this kind of separated from ourselves and apart. But if we miss that point where the Spirit of God takes this and then turns it around and hits our heart with it and shows us what this means to us, then we've missed the point, the ultimate point of the passage. And it's always an encouragement when you see and experience God doing that as you wrestle with these things. Well, the rest of this is kind of goes downhill from here. Starting in verse 9, let's read 9 through the first part of verse 15. Who would like to read that? Maybe Casey and Anna, if you guys want to split that up. Casey, you want to start and read verses 9 through 12. And then Anna, you can read verses 13 and through the first sentence of verse 15. So, before we dig into this, just remember the flow of what's happened. Gideon is filled with the power of the Lord, clothed with the power of the Spirit of God, calls 32,000 men, They go and get ready to go into battle, but yet he doubts God's ability with these 32,000 men to whip the Midianites. He does the whole test of the fleece, gets his assurance because God is being patient and gracious with him. Then they go to the spring. God says, this is too many. He subtracts 22,000. Then he subtracts another 9,700, and there's just 300 men left. How is Gideon feeling right now? He's feeling afraid. We know this man. We're getting to know him. And I appreciate the honesty of Scripture. Right? I mean, he was doubting God's ability when they had 32,000. Now they're down to 300. And so what was already with 32,000 men, Gideon was scared to death and wanted assurance. He got it. And God takes what even then would have been a miracle and he strips it away. So what's about to happen is about, I mean, it's just impossible. It is impossible. 300 men are going to go up against an innumerable number of people, soldiers, a powerful people that had whipped this nation for 7 years and kept stealing their lunch money. It's impossible. And as the Lord says, okay, now we're ready for this, he gives him two options. You notice that? He says in verse 9, arise and go down against the camp because I've given it into your hands. I've taken care of this. It's all good. But if you're afraid, take Purah, your servant, and the two of you just go down to the camp and listen to what they're talking about. And afterward, you'll have courage so that you may go down against the camp. And so, of course, what does Gideon do? At least he's consistent, right? You've given me a chance to get some fresh assurance. Okay, why did God do this? Why did the Lord give him this opportunity? Because he's compassionate. He loves us. He knows that we are just weak, frail humans. He's mindful of that. His mercies are new every morning. Right?
Same reason he gave Moses Aaron.
Yeah. Even after Moses could have led Israel by himself, he said, fine, I'll give you Aaron. I mean, he is so patient, so gracious. And so Gideon goes. And it seems like this will be the least likely way for Gideon to get strengthened for this battle. I want you to go down and go crest this mountain here and go down there. And as he goes down there, and you see what Gideon's seeing. So he went down with Purah, his servant, down to the outpost. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand of the seashore. I want you to go down there and check out all these Midianites. And no doubt as he went down there and just saw all those campfires probably and everything else that was out there and heard all those camels, I mean, his heart had to just be, you know, at the bottom of his stomach. You tell me to go down here and listen to what these guys are talking about, and that's going to encourage me? But yet, he was obedient. And he gets down there, and a man was, he overheard a guy talking to another guy, sharing his dream. He said, I had a dream. And this loaf of barley bread was tumbling, so coming down into this camp in the valley of Midian, and it came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and it turned upside down, so the tent was just completely flat. And his friend, who he was talking to, said, "Well, the only thing this can be is the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, the man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand." How did these men know Gideon? How did they know he was the son of Joash? How did they know the Lord was going to do this? Why did the tent represent Midian and the barley loaf represent Israel? How did they know how to interpret this dream? How was it that Gideon just happened to be here to hear these men talking about this? But the questions is the answer. I mean, there is no way. There is no way this just all happens. This is orchestrated by God. He set it all up. The miraculous nature of what just happened is too obvious to miss. Reminds me of Isaiah 65:24, where the Lord says, "Before you call, I will answer." I mean, the Lord told Gideon, "I've already given this people into your hand." And when Gideon goes down there, that guy had already had that dream, and he had already woken up, and he was already talking to that guy. And I mean, this was already, God was already working on the other side of the equation. And how did Gideon respond? What's it tell us there in verse 15? How did Gideon respond when he heard this? He bowed down and he worshipped. He just fell on his knees and cried, "Holy." I mean, he was filled with the realization of the greatness and the holiness of God. I mean, that was his first response. It was the right response to just worship this God. And I tell you, right there, that moment is one of the pinnacles of this story. It's just God being reverenced the way He should be reverenced. That really is what should have been happening the entire time in all this, but it wasn't. But yet God, in doing this, He gets from Gideon some of this worship that he deserves. And as Gideon fell down and worshipped God, we read there that he returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands." He came back with courage, fresh strength, and faith in God. He divided the 300 men into three companies. So 100 each. He put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them with torches inside the pitchers. So he was hiding the torches at first in the pitchers. And then he said, "Look at me and do likewise. Do what I do. Behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do the same thing I do. And when I and all who are with me..." So he took one of those companies of 100. "When we blow the trumpet, then you also blow the trumpets all around the camp and say, 'For the Lord and Gideon.'" So the battle plan was pretty simple. They were going to hide those torches at first under those jars. And they were going to have those trumpets. And we read in verse 19, "So the Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch." That's about 4 o'clock in the morning. There were three watches. The first one's from 8 to midnight, the next one's from midnight to 4 a.m., and the third one's from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. They were watching over the men during the time of the evening, the dark time, that 12-hour period, okay, when it was typically darker. And it was the beginning of the third watch. So this was right as they were changing guards. The ones who would watch would have a 4-hour shift. So this is right at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's dark. People are still in a dead slumber. Gideon and 100 come in on one side. Another 100 comes in from another side. Another 100 comes in from another side. They're sneaking up. It's dark. They're trying to be stealthy and quiet. All of a sudden, what do they do? They blew the trumpets. They smashed the pitchers that were in their hands. And so all of a sudden there was this great noise, trumpets, and what was dark. All of a sudden you had 300 torches surrounding this camp of people. And they woke up out of their slumber. And the people were yelling, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." And all they did was they stood in their place around the camp. And all the army ran, crying out as they fled. They were fleeing from these lights and the sounds of the trumpets. And when they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against the other, even throughout the whole army. And the army fled as far as Bethshitta towards Zerah, as far as the edge of Abel Meholah by Tabith. And so they were fighting each other and they were running away. All these things were happening. How did this happen? I'll give you my opinion. I didn't see anyone else say this, but this kind of makes a bit of sense to me. I think the dream that that one man had was probably not unique to him. Because not only did you have a guy who had the dream, but you had someone else who interpreted the dream. And I think God was working really strongly on these people in their dreams at night, giving them a fear of Israel, and then all of a sudden, Gideon, and then all of a sudden they wake up to hear the trumpets and the torches, you know, and they're yelling out for the Lord and for Gideon, and these dreams that they have been having and all this. They just, I mean, this is the ultimate psychological warfare. They were scared to death. They went into total confusion. They started killing each other, trying to flee, trying to get out of there as quickly as they could. God, that's why Gideon, I think, came back with such confidence. God's already doing this. God's already taking care of this. He knew what God was doing.
I think Gideon gave him the charge to say the Lord and Gideon,
mm-hmm.
because that was what they dreamt.
Mm-hmm.
Not because he was looking for glory.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. First of all, the battle was for the Lord, but God had chosen Gideon. He was the man. And so all this was taking place. And then we have the return of the 31,700. It says in verse 23, the men of Israel were summoned from Naphtali and Asher and all Manasseh. So all these 31,700 who had been dismissed, they were told, hey, the enemy's fleeing. Come on, let's finish him off. So they pursued Midian. And Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim. So he went to another tribe, Ephraim, saying, come down against Midian and take the waters before them. So cut them off at the Jordan so they can't cross and escape and get away and regather their strength and come back, essentially. So all the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they took the waters as far as Bethbara and the Jordan. They captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. Oreb means raven, and Zeb means wolf. Interesting. Raven and wolf. And they killed Raven at the rock of Oreb, and they killed wolf, or Zeb, at the wine press of Zeb, while they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon from across the Jordan. And that's the end of chapter 7. And so we see Midian is routed before Israel.